This is Deanna Spingola. It is Saturday, June 30th, 2012, and this is one of my special interviews. We have no commercials, no censorship, no calls, and no music. It's just education and information. It is bare bones broadcasting. My guest today is Richard Wilcox. He lives in Japan. Welcome to the program, Richard.
Thank you. Welcome to Japan.
And how long have you lived there?
22 years, and I live in Tokyo.
Okay. And what took you to Japan?
Back in those days, I don't know, I was just out looking for adventures, traveling around the world, and one way or the other ended up here as an English teacher. And over the years, I've been teaching at various types of schools. Today, I teach in universities in English, but I also, along the way, I earned some advanced degrees, and so I try to teach more substantive things like social and environmental issues to some of my students as well.
Sounds so wonderful.
Yeah. Oh, thank you very much.
All righty. And we met, you heard me on the radio, you on my RBN program, and then before we went on the air, you were talking about Fukushima and the nuclear disaster, which occurred on March 11th, 2011. And the first family that I thought about was yours.
Yeah, because at that time, you and I were email friends. And to some extent, I know you have a lot of supporters. And so thank you for that. Yeah, and at that time, a lot of people were very concerned and emailed or called and wanted to know what happened. And of course, we in Tokyo were not affected directly by the tsunami, or there was no major damage from the earthquake, although there was some damage even down here from the earthquake. But what people do know mostly is that the northeastern part, 200 or 300 kilometers to the northeast, is what was devastated on that afternoon. So, but and then of course a couple of days later was the news. It just kind of leaked out that, you know, the nuclear meltdowns and the explosions of hydrogen, which released who knows how much radiation compared to Chernobyl, 50% of Chernobyl releases or more, or equivalent to Chernobyl releases. Depends on who you listen to. I think the mainstream media have heard, you know, 10% only. So there's a real cover-up going on there, but so that's been the story since that time.
But what's really going on? What have you discovered? I know that you've done a lot of research in this area, and you've arrived at some conclusions that we don't hear about, and so we want to get it straight from someone who is basically close enough to tell us about it.
Yeah, exactly. It's not a good situation at the Fukushima plant, Fukushima Power Station Number 1. And people who have followed this issue, I know this show we're doing is a little bit off the focus of your other shows, which I, by the way, I really enjoy and support the other topics that you're dealing with. But I appreciate the people that are interested in hearing about this, and because it is a grave situation, I believe. And if you've piece together the news over the last year and a half, that just paints a picture of the deterioration of the power station, one thing after the other. Water leaks, they're trying to cool the cores that have melted down, and so they have to keep pouring water on them, but the water system is jury-rigged, and it has lots of flaws in it. They can't even get it close enough to some of the reactors, number 1 and 3, for example, which are so hot. They did get close to, I don't want to get too technical, but I know probably your listeners to quite a bit of an extent have followed this, so they know some of this technical stuff. But Unit 2, a while ago, they did get close enough to put a camera down in there, and they thought that it would be covered with water. I don't have to explain all the technical stuff, I guess, because people understand the melted fuel has to be covered with water, of course. So they thought there would be a lot of water there, but In fact, there was hardly any, and it was 73 sieverts of radiation, which is enough to kill you within 10 minutes if you were near there.
Oh, my
So,
word.
yeah, so the situation is one person who people can rely on for the technical understanding is Arne Gunderson, and people know his name, I think. He's been all over the internet. So somebody who has technical expertise can, and he's painted a pretty bleak picture as well as far as how one of the big issues is Unit 4, where the spent fuel is stored four stories above the reactor, and there's enough fuel in there to cause eight or 10 Chernobyls worth of radiation to be released if that fuel was exposed to the air, if there was another big earthquake and it fell over or something. And so that's been a big issue. And that's, a lot of these stories have been flying around the internet, and I think people know to some extent about that. But it's a very grave situation, because if there's another big earthquake, not only would that unit be, on fire, or the fuel would be what they call it could cause a radiological fire, but that would make it so radioactive that workers can't attend to the other nearby reactors and kind of cause a chain reaction of events that could ultimately lead to 85 Chernobyls worth of radiation being released. That's the worst case scenario. And there's a couple of Japanese diplomats, Muramatsu and Murata, who are, I think they're like retired, but they've been around for years, and they're trying to bring the story to, bring this to worldwide attention, but the international community is just kind of, ignoring the whole thing. Senator Wyden from Oregon visited the nuclear power plant, and he was shocked with how terrible it was, and went back and tried to contact Obama and Hillary, and they kind of ignored him. And so there's a few people, independent scientists and journalists and even politicians, that are involved, but there's not enough being done to, and some people say that the problems there are so technically overwhelming that there may be no solution to it, and it's going to just sit there like a metastasizing cancer. And it's just this thing where you just want to turn away. You don't want to think about it, because it's most people don't know about it, and don't, even in Japan, don't know about it and don't deeply consider it. So I talked a lot, and I just wanted to give your listeners a kind of a background of the current situation.
Right. Just refresh us.
Yes.
How did this occur? We've
yes.
heard so many different stories about how it happened and why it happened, but what is the real truth as far as you can tell?
Right. Very good. Well, there is the theory that somebody set off a mini nuke on the ocean floor. I'm open to the most, for example, I don't believe the official story of 9/11, just for example, right? But in this case, that Japan is an earthquake zone. I mean, they have 10 to 20% of the world's earthquakes, and which raises the question, why in the heck would they build nuclear reactors in such a location? So right there from the beginning, you have a disaster waiting to happen. But there was a cycle of seismic activity, and they have predicted a cycle of a few hundred years. Or, I was reading this, and I can't find the note. I wanted to reread that, but it's a quite a long-term cycle, but it's quite well understood. And TEPCO, the Tokyo Electric Power Company, had been warned several times by many different kinds of geologists that the tsunami wall was not big enough to prevent a large, major earthquake and tsunami from flooding the plant. And so, but they ignore that because they're too corrupt and arrogant and lazy and greedy. And even they had even reports from their own engineers pointing out that the tsunami wall was too small, So that's just the tsunami part of it. But the earthquake itself probably destroyed a lot of the caused a lot of the meltdown itself. And so when you combine the tsunami and the earthquake, then you have this outrageous situation where not only, and according, here I'm citing Arne Gundersen again because he's the technical expert, he said that 14 of Japan's nuclear reactors were in danger of melting down because their backup systems, their backup generators went down, and fortunately most of them came back on in time to prevent the meltdown, but Japan was this close to having 14 and not only three meltdowns, but 14 meltdowns, which is, you know, unthinkable what that would have been like. And so the tsunami, the earthquake, technical incompetence on the part of Tokyo Electric all combined the causes. Now, there's other things about the Stuxnet virus and everything, and I don't discount that, but I don't include that into my critique because I just don't understand it well enough. And if they did use the Stuxnet virus, then it was an accident waiting to happen anyway. So that is an interesting side to it. But I kind of pretty much discount the idea of a nuclear bomb being used in the ocean, though. I think that's too far out there. But
are you referring to Jim Stone's?
Yeah. I studied his article, and I couldn't make sense of it, but maybe I'm not that smart. Maybe I'm missing something, but it seemed like nonsense to me. But the idea that a computer virus had helped to mess up the system, that's plausible. But the thing is, the earthquake itself destroyed Unit 1, and I believe the earthquake was completely natural, so that's enough in itself to, you know, go on. And the behavior of the government and the power company has, before, during, and after the accident, proves their incompetence or their criminality. What they call the nuclear village, which is the combination of the utility companies, the government, and the media, academics, Tokyo University, which is the biggest, which is the top university in Japan, just like Harvard is in America. All of the Tokyo executives graduated from there, and all of the lawyers from law school. I won't tell you what I think of lawyers because this is a family program. But all of the lawyers who graduated from Tokyo University work for the government and for the Liberal Democratic Party, and who has been the party in power for 50 years, pretty much. And so there's this group, and then organized crime, they're part of it, the Yakuza. The workers in the plant today are, many of them are, you know, so they're really being exploited. But the Yakuza, the organized crime network, is part of this system as well. And the guys at the bottom, they're just cannon fodder. They're in there getting those heavy doses of radiation.
Wow. Well, yeah. I guess the big question is, why build nuclear reactors in an earthquake-ridden area?
Yes, and you've asked the perfect question, and I agree, and I think people ask that. As a teacher, I was teaching this issue to my students for many years before. There was a very good article by Lorraine Murray written in 2004 that was in the Japan Times. The Japan Times is one of the pretty much the top English newspaper in Japan. And she was warning about a different plant, which is actually closer to Tokyo, called Hamaoka. And she had researched that location and found the ground to be very soft. And she has a background in geology and so on. So, and it was a very convincing article. And so I was just going around teaching this to my students, and what do you think? And they said, yeah, that's crazy. Why does Japan have nuclear power plants? Nobody can understand it. They don't. Most people don't agree with that. But
yeah. When did they start building them?
Yeah, in the late 60s, along with the same time the generation of these Mark I reactors came online around the world. And so the world's nuclear power plants are pretty much the same age, aren't they? Late 60s, early 70s. And I think maybe I'm a little off there. It could have been early 70s because it was the oil crunch that was the pretext for Japan to adopt nuclear energy, saying, you know, this is going to save us because we can't rely on unreliable sources of oil from the Middle East. So,
and of course, that 1973 oil situation was just orchestrated to begin with.
Yeah.
And so you have to ask yourself, well, whose idea was it to build all of these nuclear reactors? And why haven't they kept them updated? And didn't they realize that there would be problems, particularly in an earthquake zone?
Yes, exactly. I think, you know, if you peel this onion, it gets really, yeah, spooky deeper down, because the motivation for nuclear power in the beginning, it's connected to nuclear weapons. I was reading a book called The Doomsday Machine by Martin Cohen and Andrew McKillop, which is an excellent book. It's an excellent anti-nuclear activist handbook, but as it's short and very readable, it's not heavy technical stuff. But they are convinced that, you know, nuclear weapons and nuclear energy are go hand in hand. Most countries want nuclear power as a cover for nuclear weapons. And so I think that's probably the reason Japan adopted it. Plus the fact that, you know, Japan doesn't have a lot of oil or any oil or natural resources of that type, carbon fuels. So it was an easy sell. But then and another fact, you know, kind of wrap up this part of what I wanted to say, they did cite, very interesting, the Japanese scientists at that time were against building nuclear power plants in Japan because of the exact question you ask, you know, how can they build these in an earthquake zone? The scientists were against it, but the political power prevailed, and then eventually the science community came on board because, you know, they were funded and bribed into going in that direction, and a whole generation of engineers, nuclear engineers, were created. And then these pesky questions about earthquake were just put to the side. And in 1995 was the Kobe earthquake. And a Kobe University professor, Professor Ishibashi, he wrote a book about how Japan's infrastructure, and especially the nuclear power plants, are very prone to earthquakes and to severe, his words are something like a severe shock or a severe damage that could occur to a nuclear power plant from an earthquake. But he was pushed off to the side and ignored.
Who is the political power there? Who actually is behind the politics?
Yes, it's the Liberal Democratic Party and the Democratic Party of Japan are two different factions, are two different parties. So the LDP, the Liberal Democratic Party, would be like our Republican Party, and the DPJ, the Democratic Party of Japan, would be like the Democrats. And so, but the differences between the two parties are minuscule. Although, at the time of the earthquake, Naoto Kan was the prime minister, and he was with the Democratic Party of Japan. And this is kind of interesting. He took a lot of heat for the whole, as if the whole disaster was his fault. Well, he did make some mistakes during the, you know, the disaster relief and so on and so forth. But I read a very convincing argument that he was removed from his post because he was so anti-nuclear. And months after the accident, he had become very anti-nuclear, was promoting renewable energy, and this would not sit well with the nuclear village, which is basically comprised, and to answer your question, the LDP, the Liberal Democratic Party, which, very misleading term because liberal and all that, but they're really the conservatives, but the LDP, the power companies, and the other shady construction industries, that's the nuclear village. They wanted him out, obviously, because He was anti-nuclear strongly and strongly pro-renewable energy. And so he was yanked out of there.
Who yanked him out?
They yanked him out and they put in this new guy named Noda, who is, he's also DPJ, which means he's more soft, but actually he's pro-nuclear. Turns out he's very pro-nuclear. And now they're restarting their, what the latest news is, they're restarting some of the reactors in another part of Japan. And that's brought out some huge protests against him, Prime Minister Noda. They had about 150,000 people on Friday in front of his house protesting, which is some good news. And we could use any good news these days over here.
Now, did the nuclear village, the people in charge of those, the industry there, are they the ones that got rid of the previous leader?
Yeah, I think so. There's a, you know, I'm a pretty good writer. If you look on my,
yes, you are.
Well, I'm here. I might as well promote my. No, if you look on my, Google my name and nuclear or Fukushima or something like that, you'll find some of my articles. But there's a professor named Jeff Kingston, who's a professor at Temple University, and he has done very excellent research about the chronology of the event. And so I would recommend reading his article called Mismanaging. I'm filing through my papers here. I would first recommend reading my articles, of course, but read his article called Mismanaging the Disaster or something like that, at Jeff Kingston of Temple University. But and he says in there that very convincingly he writes about how the previous prime minister was yanked by the nuclear village and then how the whole series of corruptions on up to Tokyo Power Company getting bailed out by taxpayers and the pseudo-nationalization of TEPCO by the government so that the taxpayers are paying for it, and yet TEPCO is maintaining the management control of the company. And even some of the top people in Japanese government were against this because they said, look, if we're going to pay for bail you guys out, we need to be in charge and radically reform the way this, you know, terrible operation is run. And yet today, Tokyo Electric Power Company is still, you know, it's the arsonists in charge of the fire. You know, it's right. Just like BP oil disaster where they cause the disaster and then they take over. And in fact, TEPCO has jurisdiction of the waters around the power plant so that people can't go in there. Independent scientists can't go in within the 12-mile radius around the nuclear power plant to check the water to see how radioactive it is.
So it's, now,
Is
TEPCO an international company, or is it national? Who owns it? Who runs it?
Yeah, well, the utilities in Japan are, there's about 8 or 10 regional utility companies, and so they are their own corporations, but now, but they've always been heavily supported by the government, for sure, with subsidies, and especially now in the case of TEPCO, they're going to get $15 billion in subsidies to help clean up this mess, which is just a drop in the bucket, really. But as far as international, I think, you know, companies like Hitachi and Toshiba, they are still going around selling nuclear technology around the world, even as this, you know, saying, buy our superior technology, even as this disaster, as they were involved in. Of course, the Fukushima plants were GE designs and everything, but there was Japanese companies involved with that too, so there's a lot of blame to share around. But what's amazing is that these companies are still going around selling their technology. In the disaster, well, it wasn't quite a disaster, in San Onofre, sorry, I mispronounced that one. In San Diego, San Onofre, the power plant there, they had just bought some big generator, expensive thing to make that plant run better, made by Mitsubishi, which is probably the biggest Japanese company, and it turned out not to function properly, And so that plant is in big trouble. So this is just crazy that Japanese companies are going around still selling their technology while this potentially earth-destroying event is unfolding right before our eyes. It's just unbelievable.
Wow, that is amazing. As a side issue, and as much as you're an educator, can you tell me if there is such a place as Savant University in Japan?
Yes, sure. I have not heard of that. Savant University, no. There's a few international universities in Japan, not very many. That's interesting. Why do you mention that?
Oh, because I had a fellow on my program that was spinning a lot of tall tales, and he said that he was a professor at Savant University in Tokyo, S-A-V-A-N-T. And in as much as he was telling so many other tales, I kind of assumed that that was also false, too. And I did look it up on the Internet and couldn't find it, so I thought that I would ask you.
Yes. Oh, yeah, that's the university I work at. No, I'm just kidding. Well, I guess when you're open-minded and you're open to information, you have to sort through lots of things. There's some questionable people, for sure. No, that is there. I don't think there's any Savant University in Tokyo. I think he's pulling your leg there.
Oh, on a number of things, yes.
Oh, I see. Okay. Well, I mentioned Temple University, and I think, you know, they're famous because they're from Philadelphia. And so they do, I'm pretty sure that they're absolutely connected, you know, to the mother university in Philadelphia, and they have quite a good reputation. There aren't that many foreign universities in Japan, but there's a few.
I'm curious that the taxpayers bailed out TEPCO.
Yeah.
And yet they, like with other huge big companies and banks, usually it's just an exchange of funds. It's just a way of taking taxpayer money when, in fact, they don't usually really need it. But because of some disaster, whether it's a real or like yours, like the one in Japan, or imagined, it seems that money exchanges hands, and it's always, the taxpayers that have to pay the bill.
Absolutely. And this is just a classic case of that. And even, even if we had to bail them out, we should have gotten the voting rights. And here, Jeff Kingston writes, even though they have two-thirds voting rights, it can't force through major management reforms. The Japanese government can't. Because all of these clever lawyers managed to keep TEPCO's autonomy while they're still being completely subsidized by the taxpayers. So this is just absolutely outrageous. He writes, the bailout and sham nationalization mean that taxpayers will be paying off the Fukushima tab for decades, and electricity ratepayers will face higher prices, even though the people who mismanaged the TEPCO disaster remain in charge, you know. So it's the same old story.
Right. Nobody gets in trouble. Nobody loses their job. Everything goes on as usual. The taxpayers, end up paying the charges for this, the enormous cost for this.
And the health costs, the radiation that we're all exposed to, and even the cost of like buying bottled water when you would normally wouldn't have had to pay for things like that, or buying a dosimeter, it's just endless.
Okay, tell me about a dosimeter.
A Geiger counter, a dosimeter. Now that's just a common thing to have in Japan. I bought one shortly after that was made in the Ukraine, and it works very well, and it's about $500. And it measures gamma radiation. It doesn't measure plutonium, for example, alpha particles, which are very different and very difficult to measure. But you can get a general idea if you're in a hot spot. And I have used it around, in my home and in my neighborhood and in various places to compare levels. And so we can talk about radiation. Tokyo's not so bad radiation wise, but it's more the food and the water type things that you have to worry about. And there are hot spots. And so, yeah, that's definitely, you know, a really big issue in itself is the radiation issue. If you want me to jump into that.
Yes, you said that you have to buy water, and of course the food and water issue. And what about the fishing industry there?
Right.
Talk to us about the health costs. What's going on with people's health?
Yeah, I mean, this is a huge, gigantic issue. And people who are fouling, you know, the alternative websites, and I'm sure, you know, American Free Press or all of the good alternative websites have been touching on these health issues. Just for the fishing industry, for example, recently discovered plutonium in fish near the power plant. It's very, very, very minor amount, but still the fact that sardines, which are a very commonly eaten food in Japan, would have any plutonium in them. I think it was 0.0008 becquerels per kilogram or something, a really tiny amount, but it's still there. And I don't think plutonium is really the big issue. It's cesium, because cesium travels much farther. And so one of the stories that was going around is that tuna were captured in California, and they detected cesium in all of the tuna that were checked, you know, which was an indication that the radiation had really spread around the ocean quite a lot, and it affected and that it was moving up the food chain, called biomagnification or bioaccumulation, as the big fish eat the small fish and up the food chain. And so salmon and tuna will have radiation in them. But recently, the fisheries in Japan have said, well, we can now start selling fish from the Fukushima area because we've checked the water, we've checked the fish, and it's safe amounts, according to them. But that means there could be cesium in the fish, but they're still going to sell it if they deem it to be below a certain level. And all over Japan, food has been contaminated with cesium. There's other radionuclides, right? But we'll just stick with cesium, cesium-134 and cesium-137.
Okay, what is that exactly?
Well, cesium 134 and 137 are two different elements that they have a half life of 30 years, and so that means they don't expire for at least 300 years, and some say much longer than that. So that's the number one radionuclide that people mention is cesium, because it's seeking. So your body mistakes it for, I think, potassium, and of course, which is a very vital element for your functioning, bodily functioning. And so it mistakes it for potassium, and that's why in Chernobyl they had what they called Chernobyl heart, where the children had holes in their heart because they'd absorbed cesium. So there, a previous government.
Oh, okay.
Holes
in their heart from Chernobyl because of the CCM?
Yeah, there's a video called Chernobyl Heart. I think people can see the documentary on YouTube. Probably very interesting.
I believe that happened also in some of the children that were raised or born in Nevada.
Sure. That's another story. There's so many stories about this whole nuclear legacy nightmare. It's sickening.
Indeed. Yeah. Yes.
I mean, thinking back to the bomb, you're talking about the bomb tests.
Yes.
And so the U.S., I mean, that's a whole other issue of all the aging reactors. And I was studying up on 3 Mile Island as well. And of course, when that happened, they said, oh, there's no problem. And even Arne Gunderson was a young engineer at the time, and he said, oh, this is no big deal. And later he gave a talk and said, well, I was wrong. And he reinvestigated it, and he helped to expose that many people did get cancer from Three Mile Island. Thousands of people were affected by that. So there's so many stories. But I think, you know, this Fukushima, it's still ongoing, and the condition of the plant is so dangerous. You don't see progress being made, and it's just, I'm trying to stay up with the technical issues. I heard about another issue called, it's where the radiation deteriorates the metal of the building, because there's been such high radiation there. So the buildings are actually deteriorating themselves because of all the high radiation. And so it's how long that takes is a question I'd like to find out, but they're certainly not getting any better, plus with the earthquakes, plus they can't get to all that melted fuel because it's too hot. The workers there was, I'm sort of rambling on, sorry.
No, that's fine. You're doing great.
It's just, I'm trying to tell this story because one thing comes to mind and then the next. I was thinking about this Japanese engineer who was in a German documentary film, TV broadcast a few months ago, and engineer Mr. Naka, who was working at the plant, he said he was very worried. Of course, this was back when a few months ago, there suddenly become a big interest in Unit 4, a fuel pool, and if there was an earthquake and if it collapsed. And so that issue had finally come to the forefront. But he also mentioned that the workers, he said, I don't know how we're going to get enough workers in the future, because this is going to go on for years, and the workers can only stand so much radiation, and then they have to stop working there. And qualified engineers, because they're also close to the plant, and they're exposed to radiation. So that's it. And they've been even advertising for workers in other countries, you know, come on over to Japan, we'll give you a visa and you'll have a great time. And then they end up working in a nuclear power plant, you know.
Right.
So there's the exploitation of workers and just the ongoing nightmare that's being covered up by the media. But people are waking up. There was 150,000 people protesting. So there's a little bit of hope on the horizon. Sorry, I got off. And,
okay, your newspapers are controlled by who?
The Rothschilds, maybe? No, I don't know. But, the newspapers are controlled by... That's very interesting. That's a forensic question I've always wondered about. And I think, you know, Japan is still a colony of the New World Order, of international capital, of the U.S. military. The U.S. military still has many military outposts and bases here. And so the news is controlled, absolutely. They can't talk about certain things. The Japan Times, just for example, they published many of my little articles, letters, about the nuclear disaster. But last year, the 10th anniversary of 9/11, I wrote a letter just saying, you know, look, the official story is rubbish. And I just laid out a few facts. And they're very nice. They usually print things that are even way outside the box, but they wouldn't print that letter. And that's because that's a topic that's taboo, you know, just for example. And so many of these hot button issues are taboo, just the same way they are in every other country. But that's a good question. Who controls the media? And I don't know exactly the answer to that.
well, after World War II, the banking industry, well, before World War II,
yes.
And during a time when Japan needed some money, they did borrow, certain companies over there borrowed money from the international bankers. And the reason that the tribunals, the military tribunals post-war, did not really go after the Japanese corporations or the Japanese so-called criminals, war criminals, was because so many people owed the bankers here in this country money, and so they let them alone so that they would be able to pay off those loans. And they also installed a gold standard over there. And so I really believe that the international bankers kind of control the economy of Japan. And you mentioned the U.S. base is still in Japan, which is indicative of that kind of a situation. Now, do you have a central bank there?
Yes, the Bank of Japan. And a friend of mine, he researched that, and he said he can't find out who owns, you know, who it's secret, who are the major stockholders.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, so that's right. Yeah, and what you just said is absolutely very fascinating, absolutely true. And I think the nuclear thing goes back to that, too, is part of this loaning money, and you do what we, you know, if you do what we tell you to do, then you can, we'll loan you more money or something like that. But
right.
There were some backroom deals being made.
Sure.
The other aspect of Japan's nuclear program is, and there's a very interesting article by Joseph Tento, about T-E-N-T-O, I believe, or T-A-N-T-O, about Japan's nuclear program and nuclear weapons development. And they have all the technology to develop nuclear weapons, and how the U.S. shared technology. And it's really interesting article because the Japan has all this plutonium. And so that's another, I think what you were elucidating is the, you know, the banking aspect to this, the international banksters, bankster gangsters. And then, the of course, weapons, guns and money. The weapons is the other side of it. So, and then we're stuck with this nuclear technology that, according to this wonderful book, The Doomsday Machine, nuclear supplies only 2.5% of global total energy production. That's total. And of course, electricity is a subset of that. And so it may supply 6% or something of global commercial electricity. But it's really a minuscule amount of energy considering how dangerous it is and really how expensive it is, too. All of the expenses of nuclear are put off into the future, into our, you know, to posterity who will have to pay for it. Decommission.
Right.
Yeah.
In more ways than one.
Yeah. Yes, so.
And of course, when you really consider, the elite really like to control all the energy on the earth, all the resources, whether it's mineral or whatever kind, food, water, all of that. Yeah. Now, another question. Do you see any similarities between the BP oil spill and the use of Corexit when you compare it to what happened there in Fukushima?
Yeah, fascinating. As I mentioned, for one, you have the arsonist investigating the fire, which is a pathological situation. I mean, the criminals who created the situation are in charge of cleaning it up. And then the Corexit aspect. Yeah, I studied the Gulf. I followed that Gulf issue quite closely at the time. And I mean, you know, there was no, it was so anti-ecological what they were doing with that it was so toxic. You know, and they're trying to cover up the issue of the oil spreading around, and the Corexit would push it down to the bottom, I guess, even if it contaminates the ocean and it makes the oil 10 times more toxic than it would have been.
Particularly when they had other choices, more natural, organic choices.
Right, right, exactly. And I mean, the parallel here is that they're hiding the truth about radiation. And there's a lot of contradictory information about radiation. And most people, I'm trying to study more and more about the radiation issue, but most people are just under the false impression that a little bit of radiation is really not going to hurt them. So if there's a little bit of radiation in their food or fish, then the Japanese have a term, shogunai, which means it can't be helped. And so, you know, and they're sort of right, because what, you still have to eat and drink and breathe. So, but most, you know, it's a real educational project because the media is telling people that don't worry, it's fine. And I think, but there's a lot of skepticism in Japan, but still there's a lot of people just going along and not thinking about the danger of it. So,
have
as
there
far as it corrects it, I'm not sure. It's the case of the fox guarding the hen house.
Right. Now, have you has there been some health issues that are very apparent since last year?
In Fukushima area, yes. They're reported very, very much on the Japanese blogs. There's a website called the Fukushima Diary where the young guy named, it's funny, I'm having a blank moment, a senior moment, I'm over 50, Iorti, he translates Japanese information into English, and it's just like an endless stream of people that say, I have a, you know, I've been having headaches or hair loss or all sorts of health issues that wouldn't normally occur, especially from people around the Fukushima area. And I treat all that skeptically because, you know, people get sick. I try to be a hard-headed natural or social scientist when I consider these things. But when you hear enough about it, when you start to see a pattern, then you think, you know, this isn't just some random person being sick. There's a pattern there. And also the fact that Japanese hospitals have said we won't treat, we won't diagnose people for radiation.
They really? Who's in charge of the hospitals there?
Yeah, right. There was one hospital that said, I think it was a major hospital. I think it's the policy. I think it's the national policy that, you know, you can't just come in and say, I think I absorbed some radiation from Fukushima. Can you check me out? They won't do that kind of a test.
Oh, so, my goodness.
Yeah, so it's a huge cover-up. But as far as the health effects, the people obviously closer are affected the most. And the workers, there's been all sorts of, you know, there's tweeting and things like that. And I take it all with a grain of salt. But, I mean, when there's enough data, you can start to see that things are happening. And people are getting sick and probably dying already from radiation exposure. Or
right.
Health, not only from, cancer. The cancer thing is about a 10. I mean, if you get into that whole issue, Chris Busby and the European Union Committee on Radiation, they have a very different model for assessing the effect of radiation. So, of course, Chernobyl, according to the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, they said about 4,000 people died from Chernobyl. Whereas, according to Yablokov, who was the top scientist in the team that wrote this book about Chernobyl called Consequences of Chernobyl or something like that, they put it up closer to 1 million people that have died up to the present day from Chernobyl. So whatever the truth is, it's a huge difference between 4,000 and 1 million. And the European Union Committee with Chris Busby, they have a totally different model for measuring the effects of radiation. So in Fukushima, you could get, a couple hundred thousand people getting sick in the next 10 to 25 years or higher. Some people say 1 million in Japan, but...
It has long-term consequences because I know people who were living in Utah at the time that they had all of the testing. And there was one gentleman that I knew, he was a kid at that time, and his uncle had a sheep ranch, and all of his sheep just died overnight. And so this kid, he was a teenager at the time, helped his uncle clean all of this up, and he died, I believe, in 2005, and this was like probably in the 1950s, I want to say, because he was born in 48, and he just died in 2005 of cancer.
Yeah.
And his wife was able to collect $50,000 from the government because they took, you know, they have this thing set up. It's called the Downwinders.
Uh-huh. That's right. I think there's a book or something called that. Yeah.
And they look to the government to say, hey, you did this. And this is the results of it. And that's what, 50 years later.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. That's the scary thing, because you might be fine today, and there's 35 million people in Tokyo, so in the Tokyo region. So it's down in the future, 10 years, 25 years, or I think our lives are going to be shortened, definitely to some extent. All of our lives, people living in this area, are affected one way or the other. By the amount of internal, the dust, the particles, the hot particles, it's not only external radiation, like how many millisieverts or microsieverts are you getting from the radiation that spread on the ground. So if you're living in that area, like in Fukushima City, they're getting very high lifetime doses just from sitting in a park. But it's also the internal particles that you breathed in at the time of the accident. They didn't get to the U.S., I don't believe. The hot particles did not, but not too badly anyway. But I know radiation from Fukushima was detected in the U.S., but these hot particles you'll breathe them in, they'll be lodged in your body, and then they're emitting radiation and affecting the cells around them, and that's what causes cancer or other diseases. So that could be what happened to the friend of yours.
Right.
It eventually caught up with them.
Now, what about what kinds of supplements and things are people taking over there to help them? I know that people recommended taking iodine.
Yes. I think iodine should only be taken if you know that you've been hit with a big dose of iodine radiation, and then the iodine blocks that. If you take it, that blocks it from being absorbed into you. But I'm not sure about taking iodine supplements. I take I try to have a healthy diet, and there are many supplements or foods that can cleanse the body, detox the body. So I think that's true, and it's recommended for everybody in this day and age, especially. But people here, I don't think they're very aware of how to detox, except from their natural diet, if they're eating a healthy diet, which people aren't necessarily even doing in Japan anymore. But
really,
because there's a lot of junk food, fast food here. Yeah,
interesting. Yeah. Well, when I was in China in 2007, I was really surprised to see McDonald's and Kentucky Fried Chicken and all that garbage.
Oh yeah, and. But I know, absolutely, I think if you take a lot of vitamins and supplements, I do for various reasons, not only for radiation, but I think charcoal is one, and I think even taking mineral baths helps to detox, and French clay baths are another way to draw the radiation out. So I think these things really do work, and they're recommended. It's worth people finding out how to. I mean, in America, some people are worried about the Fukushima, like the radiation's coming over, especially the West Coast. But so those kind of folks are already concerned about that. But you guys have a lot of nuclear plants leaking too. So
right, I think a lot of that was scare tactics, but I'm not sure.
Yeah. Oh no! Please tell me about that, because I know sometimes I even get taken in by.
Well,
what was the tactics? Yeah.
Yeah, I think somebody was saying, "Oh, thousands of babies have perished on the West Coast because of Fukushima,"
right.
And I'm thinking, "My gosh, I don't know that just sounds kind of strange to me." Now I know that the news doesn't report everything; they barely report the things that are going on that are disasters in this country.
Yeah.
We have a lot of thunderstorms in Virginia and West Virginia just today, that has caused a lot of problems. And, of course, we've got the fires raging in Colorado, and we just barely hear about them.
Yeah, right. Ecological, probably human-caused ecological disasters.
Right.
That
Now,
are,
what about the tsunami and the earthquake? Do you think that that was natural, or do you think that HAARP caused it?
Right. Well, as I said earlier, I'm open to, I've studied chemtrails, for example, and I do believe that they're spraying aerosols, and I see them. So I'm on board with that, and it's very disturbing. And, HAARP could have, that's plausible. I just don't, I haven't found enough information that I can understand that would explain where I'm really convinced by that, but I'm open to the fact that, yes, Japan is an earthquake zone, and so if they had wanted to speed up things and cause a big earthquake, maybe that could have happened, but it's speculation for me. But the key point is it was a disaster waiting to happen. It's like if you set your, if you have a bunch of money in your house and you leave the windows open and the thieves find out about it, you know. So, but yeah, I just kind of stay away from that issue. But what do you think? Do you know more about HAARP? Is that a possibility?
Well, I think I think about the situation in Indonesia. I believe in I can't remember exactly 2005,
right.
And I think and quite frankly, the U.S. government knew about that beforehand because they had records of it at Diego Garcia, which is a huge it's an island that the U.S. government military now has bases on in order
yes.
for them to, it's in the Indian Ocean, and
right.
they took it over in the 1960s, deported all the people from there, and so that they can target anything in the Middle East. And they knew about the tsunami, they knew about the earthquake, they knew that Indonesia was right in the target. It just conveniently went around Diego Garcia and didn't touch down there at all, although it seemed to be in the path. But when you look at Katrina, yeah. when you look at the earthquakes at Haiti that did not touch the other part of the island,
right.
Santo Domingo. And then, of course, you hear about the Bush and Clinton had this big humanitarian aid thing that they were collecting money, and
yeah.
now we find out that they use that money to invest in some posh hotels in Haiti.
Yeah.
So
no, it is weird. All of these chain of events that are too coincidental to be too obvious to be coincidental in a way. Yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. It's just that I think I'm open, and I know that they're doing these evil things, chemtrails, absolutely. And what are that's a whole other thing, but what are those being used for? For geoengineering or for conducting HAARP,
Sure. Now, do you have chemtrails in Japan?
Yes. Yes. And that's kind of an issue I was working on before Fukushima, and I was taking photographs and corresponding some with Mike Murphy because he was making those films back then.
Right. I've had him on my program.
Sure. And just a quick story, I think how it works in Tokyo is if you go out to the countryside area to the east, if you travel east, you will see them spraying the chemtrails during the day, but they blow back over Tokyo, and then by the time they get here, they're all kind of dispersed and muddied up. But unless you really look for this, most people wouldn't identify persistent jet contrails. They just think it's normal, unless you point it out to them.
Right.
But it's, it was only recently in the last few years that I even figured that one out. So, but once you, it's like one of these things, once you really look at it, like Building 7, once you examine it, there's no other conclusion that this is not the way it should have been.
Right. Well, this has been very, very interesting.
Thank you.
I really appreciate you joining me today, and I hope we can do this again.
Oh, really? Yes, I'd love to. Thank you so much for, helping to get this information out to people, and I hope people will, not let this Fukushima issue think that, well, it's over and now it's just a matter of time, because it's an ongoing crisis and it's very scary. I mean, the one little thing I could leave people with is if they can email, and I know it's so futile to email your congressperson, but anything that they can think of to put political pressure to force Japan to deal with the site more, aggressively, I think should be done. So,
Right. Now, do you have a website? I know that you post on activistpost.com.
I have a blog that someone set up for me called Environmental Armageddon, but so if you type in, it's a long address, so I can't really give it over the air, but
Okay, just
richardwilkes.com.
send it to me and I will post it with this audio file.
Right. Thank you. Yeah, but I think it's called Environmental Armageddon, and it has a bunch of my articles, Richard.
Okay.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me on, Deanna, and it was great to meet you.
Well, it was great to meet you and finally talk to you after exchanging so many emails.
Yeah.
Okay, let's do this again. So, thank you very much, Richard.
Thank you. I will. I hope so. Okay, take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.